All right, tonight we're in Genesis chapter 50. And so the plan is tonight to be here for the better part of an hour, I guess. And then the plan is to finish up Genesis in one more hour, at least, to discuss the typology of Joseph as he points us to Christ. And so that would be the plan for next time we're together. But tonight we are going to finish up, Lord willing, here, the the book of Genesis. It's been a long road. So let's pick up in verse 1. Before we do that, just to recap, because it's been a couple weeks. Genesis 49 is about the blessings and quite frankly, some not-so-blessings that Jacob spoke over each of his sons. And you can see in verse 28, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel after he had spoken these words. This is what their father said to them. When he blessed them, everyone, with the blessing appropriate to him. And then verse 29, he charged them and said to them, I'm about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with the fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. And then verse 33, when Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. So Jacob is now dead. He dies at the ripe old age of 147 years. And that's where we'll pick up in verse 1. Chapter 50. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. Now 40 days were required for it, for such is the period required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. And when the days of mourning for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, If now I have found favor in your sight, please speak to Pharaoh, saying, My father made me swear, saying, Behold, I am about to die. In my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father. Then I will return. And Pharaoh said, Go up and bury your father, as he made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, and all the household of Joseph and his brothers and his father's household. They left only their little ones and their flocks and their herds in the land of Goshen. Verse 9. There also went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and sorrowful lamentation. And he observed 7 days mourning for his father. Now when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, This is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians. Therefore it was named Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. So let's stop there. So, verse 1, Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him. We've seen before, and we've mentioned before, Joseph is a very emotional guy. This is not the first time, obviously, that Joseph has wept. And so Joseph was very happy to see his father, Jacob, who came down from Canaan. And Joseph was obviously able to provide for Jacob and his whole family. And so now Joseph is rightfully saddened by his father's death. Of course, we remember that Joseph was Jacob's favorite as well. So there was a bond there between the two of them that was stronger than with any of the other sons. Verse 2, Joseph commands his servants to embalm his father. And so we see in verse 3, 40 days required for this embalming. So this was obviously, if you know history, specifically Egyptian history, they had by this time come to the place where it was very much a science, the science of embalming. They were experts at it. They had done this for many generations. And so Joseph now, who is not just descended from Jacob, but he's now the vice president, as it were, or prime minister of Egypt, he orders for his father's body to be embalmed. One of the things that this allows for is it allows for travel time to get from Egypt up into Canaan, right? So they're able to take Jacob's body intact up and to bury it intact in the cave at Mamre, the cave that Abraham had purchased. And he says so that it would just take some time for them to get there. And so as a tradition, an Egyptian tradition, Joseph has Jacob's body embalmed. We can talk about that a little bit more later if you want. But at the end of verse 3, the Egyptians wept for Jacob for 70 days. This is probably cultural. Someone high, and of course the father of the vice president would have had high esteem in the nation of Egypt, and so probably the 70 days is the fullness of days that they would have wept for someone who was in such a high office, someone in the household of Pharaoh, for example. Verse 4, the days of mourning for him were passed, so the 70 days had passed, and Jacob's body is now fully embalmed. Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, "If now I have found favor in your sight, please speak to Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear." If you want to go back and see that, just turn back a page or so. Genesis 47, 29, you may remember the episode, Genesis 47, 29. So Jacob had thought some time ago that he was going to die, right? At the end of Genesis 47, when the time for Israel to die drew near, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "Please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt." In verse 31, Joseph actually swears to him that he would not be buried in Egypt, but that his bones would be carried up and buried in Abraham's grave. And it's likely that what's going on here in terms of, because you'll see later that Pharaoh says to Joseph, verse 6, "Go up and bury your father as he made you swear." So Joseph is so why doesn't Joseph go to Pharaoh himself and request leave? And it's probably just relatively pragmatic. Joseph is in Goshen. He is taking care of his father's affairs, right? He's overseeing the embalming, those types of things. And so he sends, he spoke, verse 4, he spoke to the household of Pharaoh, and he makes this request of Pharaoh. And he tells him in verse 5 that his father made him swear that he would not be buried in Egypt. And of course, verse 6, it's no surprise to us as we understand the relationship between Pharaoh and Joseph, that Pharaoh says, verse 6, "Go up and bury your father as he made you swear." So verses 7 through 9 are very, very interesting. So Joseph went up to bury his father. And with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of Egypt. Verse 8, and all the household of Joseph and his brothers and his father's household. Verse 9, there also went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company. So for those of us who have been reading through for the last couple of years, at least the Old Testament in a year, this may sound familiar to you. So do me a favor and turn to Exodus 12. Exodus 12. Exodus 12, the end of Exodus 12, is a recounting of the Exodus. The Exodus of Israel out of Egypt. So this is more than 400 years later. Okay, but let's read Exodus 12, verse 37. So near to the end of the chapter of Exodus 12. Now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. Verse 38, so important. And a mixed multitude also went up with them, along with flocks and herds, a very large number of livestock. Okay. And then it goes through the end of verse 41. But verse 38 is very important, right? You can read over it. If you read over it quickly, you might miss it, right? At the Passover, 400 years after Genesis 50, Moses records that a mixed multitude went out of Egypt. What does that mean? It means that it wasn't just the Jews, the descendants of Jacob, who went out of Egypt to follow Yahweh, but also some of the Egyptians joined them. And why? Why? Well, if you remember, what happens in the early portions of Exodus? These 10 judgments on the people of Exodus, right? The 10 plagues, which, you know, eventually we'll get to as we go through Exodus here on Wednesday night. And those 10 plagues, although they were not enough to convince Pharaoh to be a believer, as it were, apparently those plagues and those judgments, the power that was manifest by Yahweh, God of Israel, was sufficient to convince some of the Egyptians that this God really meant business. Okay? And so they come up out of Egypt with the Israelites. And so what I want you to see here back in Genesis chapter 50, verses 7 through 9, is a prefiguring of that Exodus. A prefiguring of that Exodus. I mean, verse 7, it's very clear. These are Gentiles who are leaving Egypt to go up into Canaan to pay their respects to Jacob. Verse 8 is the Jews. So you have verse 7, the Gentiles. Verse 8, the Jews. Verse 9, it was a very great company. Do you see that? So significant. All right? And so there's this prefiguring here, okay, of the Exodus in Genesis chapter 50. Those who would become Israel. Because if you remember, there were stipulations in the Mosaic Law for Gentiles to become Israelites. And a few years ago, Pastor Mike preached, you know, an incredible sermon on the mikvah bath and how what are called proselytes, Gentile converts to Israel, and the ritual bath that they had to take, among other things, they also had to be circumcised to come into the nation Israel. So there were stipulations in the Mosaic Law for Gentiles to become attached, to attach themselves to the nation Israel. And we see here in Genesis chapter 50 a prefiguring of that. Gentiles joining themselves and paying homage to Israel, who was Jacob. All right, really significant there. Verse 10, we see they come to the eastern side of the Jordan. They lamented there with a very great and sorrowful lamentation. And then there were 7 days mourning for his father. So more mourning here before they go into Canaan. And even the Canaanites on the west side of the Jordan were watching this and were impacted by it, right? And they saw it as a what? They saw it as an Egyptian mourning, right? It was very clear to them that the Egyptians were in the camp there. Verse 12. And thus his sons did for him as he had charged them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field at Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham had bought along with the field for a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. So if you want to go back and see the transaction that occurred when Abraham bought this particular cave in the field, we don't go back there tonight, but you can go back. That's Genesis chapter 23. You can go read that account. And then it's very interesting here, verse 14. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers. Okay, so there's two aspects here. First is Joseph's return. Okay, Joseph is the vice president of Egypt. And if you go back to verse 5, when he has the household of Pharaoh speaking to Pharaoh and requesting leave to go bury his father, he says, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I'm about to die in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. There you shall bury me. Joseph speaking to Pharaoh. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father. Then I will return. right? And so the bottom line here for Joseph is that he still has a position. He still has a job to do, okay? And so it's easy for us to understand why Joseph would return to Egypt. What is more interesting here, and it's spoken as a fact without any explanation whatsoever, is the fact that not only Joseph returned to Egypt, but also his brothers returned to Egypt. Okay? Very interesting. Okay? And anything I say after this point is mere speculation because it's obviously not in the text. One could think or might think that Joseph's brothers, the other 11 brothers, would stay in Canaan. That's where their father is from. They had previously lived there. The famine is over, right? It's been some time, obviously, right? But Joseph's brothers, the descendants of Jacob, also return to Egypt with no explanation whatsoever, except that's what God told Abraham would happen. Right? In Genesis chapter 15, let's go back to Genesis 15, this great chapter, which R.C. Sproul said that if he had only one chapter with him on a deserted island, he might say it was Genesis 15. This great Abrahamic covenant. And you remember this 15:6, very important. Abraham believed in Yahweh, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. This very important verse that is oft quoted in the New Testament. And then there's this covenant cutting ceremony, right? Verse 9, God says to Abraham, bring me a 3-year-old heifer and a 3-year-old female goat, right? And then cut them in two, verse 10, laid each half opposite each other. The birds of prey came down upon the carcasses. Abraham drove them away. Verse 12, now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. Verse 13, and God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. Right? So although we don't have any sort of explanatory words from Moses here about what drives Joseph's brothers back to Goshen, what we do know is that God had already told Abraham two generations earlier that this is in fact what they were going to do. And this will lead then to, as we'll see in Exodus, a Pharaoh who did not know Joseph and then who enslaves the people of Israel, which then sets the stage for God's great salvific work in the Exodus. All right? Verse 15. Genesis 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph should bear a grudge against us and pay us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him? So they sent a message to Joseph, saying, your father charged before he died, saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? And as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. This is literally one of the most incredible paragraphs in the Bible. Okay? Verse 15. The brothers are now commiserating. Now, so obviously they saw their father, Jacob, as the person who was standing between Joseph's revenge, and them. right? That's one of the aspects in which they view their father. And now that their father Jacob is dead, that arbiter is gone. And so now they're commiserating amongst themselves about the potential for Joseph to finally pay them back after all these years for the wrongs that they had done to him. We see that their consciences after all these years are still not at peace. Okay? And it's interesting because I can't remember exactly which commentator I was reading because it was some time ago now. It might have been a couple weeks ago. But if you turn with me just for a second to Proverbs 28:1. I thought this was a good cross-reference. Proverbs 28:1. 28:1a specifically. Proverbs 28, verse 1a. The wicked flee when no one is pursuing. You see that? Is Joseph after his brothers? No. But they think he is. And this is what a guilty conscience will do to us. Okay? We will see things behind trees that are not there, right? That's what we will see. We will assume that someone is acting in a certain way towards us when they are not. And this is exactly what's going on here. Their consciences have not been appeased yet. Verse 16. So they sent a message to Joseph, saying, "Your father charged before he died, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now please forgive the transgressions of the servants of the God of your father.'" Now, here's a question. Is verse 16 true? Did Jacob want this message to be given to Joseph? The answer is, we don't know. I suspect not. Okay? I suspect not. And I think the bulk of the commentaries are on that side. I suspect this is a story. But I will say this, verse 17. There's a clear confession of sin and transgression here. Okay? They're not attempting to sugarcoat what they did, even if the story is in fact made up. You've got three words, right? We've got transgression, we've got sin, we've got transgression again. These are serious words. These are the words that the Old Testament often uses for sin and transgression. Okay? And there's an appeal here. Do you see that at the end of the quotation? Please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father, right? He's enlisting the God of Israel in their request for forgiveness. All right? At the end of verse 17, Joseph wept when they spoke to him. And these are the messengers. Because the brothers don't actually come until verse 18. Right? So there's a sense in which they're trying to... Do you remember when Jacob was coming back into Canaan and he sent the herds ahead of him to sort of appease Esau? Right? It's clearly what's going on here. Sending out the sort of the peace party. And Joseph weeps for this. There's no explanation for the emotions that Joseph is going through, right? It could be that, and I would guess from the context and what comes after is that Joseph is most upset because he thinks that his brothers think that he's still bearing a grudge after all that he's done for them, right? There's a sense in which, how could you think this of me after everything that I've done for you? Right? So I'm not saying that it's crying for self-pity necessarily, but he certainly he may feel misunderstood. Right? Misunderstood. Verse 18, his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." What does that remind you of? What's that? Yeah, the dreams, right? Way back in Genesis chapter 37, there were these dreams that Joseph had that his brothers would come and bow down to him. And we've seen that before. We saw the fulfillment of that previously when they didn't know that it was Joseph. They thought it was merely the vice president of Egypt. But now we see it again, right? This homage even that they're paying to their brother. And then 19 through 21 are just some of the most incredible verses in the Bible. They really are. Joseph says to his brothers, "Do not be afraid." That's the first time. "Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place?" Now, what's the answer to that question? There's obviously a sense in which the answer is no. Joseph is not God. But there's also a sense in which the answer to that question is yes. Because Joseph is the vice president of Egypt. And these brothers are now under his jurisdiction. And I am sure if Joseph gives the order, it's over. He's obviously appealing to the fact that he's not the ultimate judge of them. But I would argue, and we'll see this again next time we're together, that what Joseph is showing here is an incredible amount of restraint. Translation, mercy and grace. In not immediately annihilating those who had sinned against him so grievously. And there's so much New Testament gospel implication in that that we'll get into next time. And then verse 20, which as you listen to sermons and teachings on God's sovereignty, almost always Genesis 50:20 comes up. Some theologians say that Joseph had 50:20 vision, right? We say 20:20 vision. Joseph had 50:20 vision. He says, "And as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive." Go back with me to Genesis 42:36. 42:36. I'm going to do a little compare and contrast here. This is Simeon is held hostage in Egypt. The brothers have now been sent back. And if you remember, they had found money, right? Their money in their bags. And so they get back to their father, Jacob. And they're explaining to him what they saw. Verse 29, they came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan. Verse 30, the Lord of the land spoke harshly to us. Verse 33, the Lord of the land said to us, "By this I shall know that you are honest men. Bring your youngest brother." Verse 34, "Now it came about as they were emptying their sacks that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack." And Jacob's watching all of this transpire, not knowing what's going on. We know what's going on, but Jacob doesn't know what's going on. Verse 36, "And their father Jacob." Now look at Jacob's perspective on this, what's going on. "And their father Jacob said to them, 'You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and you would take Benjamin. All these things are against me.'" Jacob doesn't have yet 50-20 vision. But as Joseph looks back on the entirety of this episode, even though Jacob in 42:36 thought that all of these things were against him, Joseph says, "God meant it for good." and even at the beginning of verse 20, as for you, brothers, you meant evil against me. And they did. Go back and read the account of them. First, they were trying to kill him. They wanted to kill him. They throw him in a cistern, right? And then Judah gets this idea, let's just sell him. At least let's make a profit. If we're going to get rid of him, let's get some cash out of it. And then they dip his robe in blood. They tear it to shreds. The whole thing. There's no doubt about it that all of that was meant for evil. And how do we know that? Just from Genesis chapter 50 here. Look it back at the story they're making up. If they're indeed making it up. Their consciences are not appeased. They know what they did was wrong. They know that what they were doing was evil. Joseph knows that what they intended was evil. Joseph has this 50-20 vision. He sees that even the sins of men, the evil intentions of men, God uses these things for the good of his people. Romans 8:28. Paul is so convinced of this. Where do you think Paul gets Romans 8:28? Now, was I there when he wrote Romans 8:28? No. But he certainly knows this story. And so when he writes, we know that all things, do you see that? There's no qualification on that. All things work together for good for those who love God and are called according to his purpose. Even our beheading, in Paul's case, work for good. And this is exactly the view that Joseph had. Now, this is a guy, right? I mean, anybody in here spend 3 years in prison? Wrongfully? No, it's not like Joseph's life. Joseph's life has been one of ease. And yet he sees the overarching goodness of God's sovereign hand in everything that happened. And for what purpose? In order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. He sees not only is God working for good in his own life, but in the good of his family. For the good of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All of these people to whom he has made these promises. Verse 21, so therefore do not be afraid. The second time he says it. Do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. So Joseph comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Now, let's go back. Genesis 37, verse 4. And I'm going to ask you an easy question after we go back to Genesis 37, verse 4. So the first question from Genesis 37, verse 4. And his brothers, Joseph's brothers, saw that their father Jacob loved him more than all his brothers. So they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. They could not speak kindly to him. So the fact that they could not speak kindly to him was a manifestation of their hatred toward them. In Genesis 50:21, the fact that Joseph could speak kindly to his brothers is an obvious manifestation of what? His love for them. His willingness to be gracious, to be merciful, to forgive their transgressions, and to love them, even though they didn't deserve it. So Joseph's ability to speak kindly to his brothers is in direct contradiction to their hatred for him way back at the beginning of this story. Verse 22. Now Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household. And Joseph lived 110 years. And Joseph saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons. Also the sons of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were born on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. So Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. So a couple things as we wrap up here, Genesis chapter 50. Verse 24, God will surely take care of you. Literally, that says God will visit you. It's just the same thing in verse 25. God will visit you. That's a very important word in the Old Testament. God's visiting his people. It's a very personal arrival for the purposes that he has planned out for them. Okay? So it's a very important word as you read the Old Testament and you see that word, God visits his people. There's a lot of theology in that word. God will surely visit you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. There's a few things here. Number one, first and foremost, we see that Joseph believes the promises of God. From Genesis 12, Genesis 15, Genesis 17. The promises given to Abraham. Where did he learn those promises? He learned them from his father. Joseph is a believer in the promises of God. And although it doesn't say it, I can only assume that Joseph not only believed God, but it was credited to him as righteousness. Also very significant in verse 24, the end of verse 24, this identification of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. It's the first time that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob appear in this context. You will see it all the way through the rest of the Old Testament and even into the New Testament. The God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. All right, it's very, very common phraseology. Right, Jacob, of course, being Israel, the father of the nation Israel. But this is the first time. So theologically speaking, when you see something, a phrase or something occurring the first time, it's theologically significant. And what we see here, why is it significant here? It's significant because we're about to finish up Genesis, which is the record of the patriarchs. And we're about to go into Exodus, which is the beginning of the story of Moses. And Moses is about to meet, just in three chapters, at the burning bush, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So Moses is now setting up for us, right, the 400-year window, and then God appearing in the burning bush to begin to deliver his people out of slavery, out of Egypt, to save them through the Red Sea. That's what's happening here. And of course, in verse 25, Joseph also, after the pattern of his father, does not want to be left in Egypt. Man, I mean, this is really significant, right? He spent, you know, the bulk of his life in Egypt, not just as a citizen, but as the vice president of Egypt. And yet, he wants his bones to be carried out of Egypt 400 years later, to be carried out of Egypt and taken back into the land of Canaan, which was the land that God promised to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Okay? So with that, we come to the end of Genesis. Here, like I said, we'll do one more session, Lord willing. And I would just say, in closing, as we consider Romans 8:28, this idea that Joseph says to his brothers, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." I just wrote this down in my Bible, this quote from John Calvin, which just affected me. Here's the quote. "Whatever poison Satan produces, God turns into medicine for his elect." Whatever poison Satan produces, God turns into medicine for his elect. So let's have that perspective. Let's have Joseph's 50-20 vision. Amen.